Welcome back to the second hour of the 9 till noon show on this Friday morning. It's the 3rd of October. There is a yellow wind warning coming into effect in the next 2 hours. And then at 2 o'clock this afternoon, an orange wind warning comes into effect. I can tell you, the weather is actually getting quite heavy out there. The rain is really coming down now. I was out for a walk earlier on this morning and it was quite nice and pleasant, but we knew it was on the way. It's now coming, so as predicted, it's raining and the wind will start to pick up in the coming hours. So please do be careful out there and just bear those warnings in mind as you go about your day. It is Donal Kavanagh on the show this morning. And if you're wondering why it's Donal on the show and not Greg, I can tell you that Greg and Oisín and a large crew from the station are en route to Kilkenny, to the Lara Estate Hotel in Kilkenny. Oisín is shortlisted for Sports Broadcaster of the Year. The 9 till noon show with Greg is shortlisted for the Best Interactive Speech Programme, and the news team, including Greg and Oisín and Shannon and Caroline and a whole host of support staff, is shortlisted for the local regional news programme, and specifically that's in terms of our election coverage. And this is all part of the IMRO Radio Awards, which are taking place, as we said, tonight in Letterkenny. So Highland nominated in three areas, and all the best to the team who are on their way down. Delighted for Oisín, actually, because, I mean, the work Oisín puts into sport is amazing. And again, he's got a great team behind him as well. So, and great to see Greg, too, nominated for the programme, and Caroline and Shannon and the whole team behind it. And look, I'm just going to stress again, look, for all the programmes that get nominated on something like this, the reason they're nominated is we have teams of people whose names you sometimes hear but don't always see. And without them, this wouldn't be happening. So, look, it's great to be nominated. It's great to be in with a chance of taking these awards, and a really interesting and exciting night to come. I just want to say again a very special thank you to the three members of our Friday panel over the course of the first hour. We had Leonard Watson, owner of Watson's Menswear in Letterkenny, also a leading figure in Letterkenny Chamber. We had Councillor Declan Meehan, independent councillor on Donegal County Council representing the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. And we also had Brendan Byrne, a former councillor, of course, and the CEO of the Irish Fish Producers and Exporters Association. And if you missed that, or if you didn't get to see it, we will of course be podcasting the programme on our website highlandradio.com later on. You can also watch back on our Facebook pages and also on our YouTube channel Highland Radio Ireland, where the programme is available to watch, of course, all through the day. Just a few of your comments before we go to the bingo numbers and then a break. And we'll have Seamus Gunn, as we said, after the break, looking at some of your legal questions and also looking at some of the legal issues surrounding that flotilla and the maritime law that has, it's claimed, been breached by Israel. Looking at some of our calls, caller says, has Ireland not acted illegally against her own people by denying us a choice in the presidential election when they blocked by foul means independent candidates from being on the ballot papers? This corrupt government just wants a flock of sheep captive in their pens. Now, I think, number one, Catherine Connolly would take grave exception to be categorised as a government supporter who's going to keep sheep captive in their pens on the part of the government. I don't think Catherine Connolly or her team would agree with that. And in fairness, I don't think Heather Humphreys and Jim Gavin would agree with that either, but particularly Catherine Connolly. I suppose the answer to that you're going to get from government is that there are processes laid out, and those processes were absolutely followed to the letter, both in terms of the decision of Aruchlis members to nominate, as is their right to nominate, and the decisions of county councils up and down the country. And this is a discussion we'll be having, I suspect, again and again. Got a note in from the Trenta Presbyterian Church, and they just ask, could you please announce that we are cancelling events this weekend as a result of Storm Amy. A number of events had been scheduled to take place at Trenta Presbyterian Church this weekend. They've been announced on some of our programmes over the past while, but because of the predicted stormy weather, Trenta Church are cancelling the events that were to take place in the church there over the course of the weekend. Caller says, we should be talking about how the OPW is managing its funding. Look how quickly we've forgotten the bike sheds, the security huts, and God only knows what else that we haven't heard of. That goes back to the discussion we were having on the closure of Glenveagh Castle for 2 days a week. Caller says, £5.50 for a cone last Sunday in Donegal Town. Now, if I were paying £5.50 for a... Now, I don't know, is that your standard Mr. Whippy-style cone with a flake in it? Or is it a specialised gelato cone with your different flavoured ice creams in it? I'm not sure, but certainly if it's a standard Mr. Whippy cone, £5.50, even if it's a 99, that seems very, very high. And I suppose the bottom line is, when it comes to things like cones, if the shop you're buying it in seems to be too exorbitantly expensive, I'm sure there's another shop or a facility not too far away where you may potentially get a better deal. The biggest problem we have is vulture funds and bad government policies. They need to rethink the policy and step up and ban the vulture funds from buying up all the property being built. Local people, especially in rural Ireland, should be able to do whatever they want with their own property. If that means Airbnb or rentals, it's not the government's place to tell people what to do. Citizens should not be punished for bad decisions, so says a caller. People worked, they've paid their taxes, they bought a second house. Now they can't let that second house out as they wish just because the government can't build houses. This country is a joke. Caller says, I got a letter from Revenue regarding the property tax for this year. Firstly, I think it's ridiculous that I'm paying a charge for something I've bought and paid for already, but that's the Irish system. Telling me I had to get my house valued for 2026. Being a dutiful citizen, I called to have this done. It cost me €150 for the pleasure for them to try to tell me my house is now valued at €350,000 in today's market. That's some jump for a modest three-bedroom, one-sitting-room, one-kitchen and one-bathroom house built in the 80s. This now leaves my property charge at €330. This year's property tax is now costing me €388 extra, up from the €95 I usually pay. Am I the only one thinking it's time for a revolution? So asks a caller. We briefly discussed in the programme Catherine Connolly and the issue of the person that she had employed who had a criminal record and had done time in prison. A caller says, Catherine Connolly did the right thing and Fianna Fáil have a cheek to use this against her in the next general election. They'll be asking for another chance after decades of failure. Hope they have the sense not to call at my door. Another caller says, and we're going back to the flotilla, not one mention of the hostages, no one on the panel to speak for the Jews and Israel. The flotilla is a publicity stunt on behalf of Hamas, an extreme jihad terror group who would do to us what they have done to Israel if and when necessary. Also, a caller asks, can you bring this up? I needed a high-vis top. I went onto the RSA site. Everything is out of stock, running bib and armbands. They say to wear high-vis and the RSA can't even stock these. It's been out of stock for some time. I do know that on occasion, the Scartha station will have them. So what I would suggest is potentially if you were to call your local Garda station, I can give absolutely no guarantees here, but I know certainly from time to time Garda stations will have high-vis available, so you might want to give your local Garda station a call to see what's available there. Right, it's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's 17 minutes past 10. We're going to take a short break. After the break, Seamus Gunn answers your legal questions and we'll be speaking about the legal implications and background to the flotilla and what's been happening over the past 48 hours. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio and it's a Friday morning and that means it is time for our discussion with solicitor Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company in Remelton and Letterkenny. Seamus, a very good morning to you. Good
morning, Donald. How are we?
Very well indeed.
Congratulations to all the team down in Kilkenny.
Oh, thanks, Will. Well deserved
and well merited, yeah.
Well, the nominations. The nominations certainly are.
They're punching way above their weight, so they are.
Oh, well, I couldn't possibly comment on that. As the man says.
They're leaving a good man in the dugout.
Well, I do have skin in the game as well now in what's going on down there too. But hey, happy days. Thanks very much indeed. Seamus, we're going to get to people's legal questions in just a moment. But before we do, we want to talk about maritime law and the whole issue regarding the flotilla. Now, I'm going to declare a kind of an interest in this in terms of maritime law, because way back in the last century, in the 1980s, I spent time on pirate radio ships, one of them coincidentally off the coast of Israel, actually called the Voice of Peace, and the other, the famous Radio Caroline, in the North Sea, midway between the UK and France. And I've always taken an interest in maritime law from that point of view, because the whole raison d'etre of pirate radio was that international waters were international waters and no state could interfere with what happened on international waters, provided it was not in direct contravention of maritime law. Now, what we've seen over the course of the past 48 hours is hundreds of activists, 22 in total of them from Ireland, effectively detained and taken to land forcibly by Israeli forces. They were docked into Ashdod and they are now about to be deported. Those arrangements are in place. What is the legality regarding the decision of the Israeli administration to send out naval vessels and to board the vessels on that flotilla while they were still in international waters?
It's well recognised that the international law recognises the high seas and the freedom of navigation within the high seas. And we're talking about the Mediterranean here and a humanitarian mission. So they should be allowed free passage without any interruption, interference or hindrance to go about their business. In this particular instance, it is a mission it should be allowed to proceed in the normal manner. However, does international law really matter in this case? This is the fundamental point that I think that has to be addressed. In 2024, it was declared that Israel's occupation of Palestine was illegal. That was by the International Court. You have an ICC warrant issued last November 2024 against Benjamin Netanyahu in relation to crimes against humanity and genocide, by the way. And you have him appearing on different world stages, which obviously on ones that don't recognise the ICC. So in relation to the high seas, yes, of course they should have freedom of movement, and they should be able to go about their business and their mission. But international law is not applying. The International Court of Justice's regulations are not being applied. And that is the modus operandi of this entire siege and genocide that is taking place in full view and in Gaza at the moment. And if nothing else, though, what this may achieve, because this isn't going to stop here with this particular flotilla. There's already another one following up 9 or 10 miles out. There's still the Marinette, I think, up to 2 hours ago. It's still forging on to try to reach Gaza. Now, it is, in all probability, going to be intercepted. But there are going to be more following, and that's the important point. And if it does nothing else but garner the support of governments, which have been a little bit lukewarm in their support to date, but if it does do that and that alone, to put the spotlight properly where it should be on Gaza and the atrocities that have been allowed to continue for now coming to the second anniversary, it will have achieved vastly more than they ever could have expected. So that's the whole purpose of the mission. The maritime law is incidental, unfortunately. It should be observed. Of course it should be observed. But the law has not been observed anywhere here. You have genocide, so we have famine. You know, how bad can it get? We're talking about people being apprehended on the high seas. They're being brought in. They're probably waiting for a hearing. The first, literally, with regard to the legal status too, if they're going to be deported, they'll have a number of forms likely to fill out. And one of them will be asking or inquiring to accept that they have entered the country illegally. That's a question that'll be put to them whenever they're incarcerated in Israel, and probably might be even happening now. If they refuse then to sign those, they'll go before a judge for a hearing within 72 to 96 hours, and then likely be deported. But then it will follow the same again. But once those people, the Irish and all the others up to 500, have been kidnapped actually on the high seas. That's what's happened. Sure, that's a breach of every law, never mind the maritime law.
The irony here too.
But does that matter? That shining the light on that is a side issue as against what this is really all about. And this is about the atrocities that are being allowed to continue on a daily, weekly, hourly basis in Gaza, and the world standing by and witnessing it and really not doing enough about it.
On the basis of what you said, the irony here is, of course, that these people have been forcibly brought to the port of Ashdod against their will by the Israeli forces. So, I mean, did they enter Israel illegally? No, they were brought into Israel against their own wishes. So if the illegality in this situation is on the part of Israel, not on the part of them, they were heading toward Gaza. I would ask you the question, though, because I find this interesting. If Israel, as you said, if the occupation of the of what we regard as Palestine is illegal, where does the sovereignty, in inverted commas, over that coastline lie? Because we know much of the lands of Palestine would previously have been, in the case of Golan Heights, it would have been in Syria. In the case of, I think Gaza would have previously been Egyptian, if I'm correct, and then a lot of the West Bank would have been with Jordanian. So would Egypt technically then be legally, in the eyes of the UN, the sovereign country that has jurisdiction over that coastline of Gaza?
They haven't made that point yet. If we go back historically, way back, 2,000 years ago, for that 1,000 millennium, Israel would have been in occupation of that particular strip of land, I believe. And then it came to Palestine in the next 1,000 years or so. So that's the divide between them. Now, you're asking as to the proposed peace move, which has been put forward by Trump and all the different points within it, are considering some type of international intermediary government that will move in there and govern until such time as the authorities are up and running again and the state agencies are up and running again. And will it then go back to Palestine? Remember that Palestine as a state has now been recognised by an awful lot of the major powers in the world. So it has its right to its own autonomy. Gaza has been razed to the ground as we speak. In the proposed peace initiative, there doesn't seem to be any mention as to who's going to be responsible for the rebuilding of that entire city and all and that particular land and the restructuring of it. There's an awful lot of grey areas with regard to the proposed peace initiative, whether Hamas are going to now become involved or participate or not. That's in the melting pot. But they probably have no choice, because when was the last time that we hear that Hamas was retaliating against Israelis? It's just an obliteration at the moment. That's what's happening in Gaza, and nothing more than that. So Hamas is nearly, in my view anyway, and I am absolutely no expert, Hamas is more or less practically wiped out on the ground from what any observation from this side of the world would dictate. So in that respect, there's going to have to be some movement with regard to this particular initiative. But again, the elephant in the room is one of the main participants, the main participant, and the victims, the people of Palestine, haven't been involved in these talks or these proposals. That seems to me to be a big issue, and one that you're going to have to be addressed. And they're also going to have to probably bring in some of the other players like Qatar, maybe, and maybe Egypt, as you've said, to see what role that they can play going forward. But I would be horrified to think that the whatever good this peace initiative is, that at least it can be advanced somewhat to move matters on. But in the meantime, the flotilla, I think, deserves all our support, and it's very well named as the Sumud flotilla, because that means steadfast perseverance in the eyes of adversity, and you have to hand it to those on it for taking their own lives in their own hands and taking severe risks in order to highlight what are the atrocities in Gaza at the moment.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Seamus. Let's move on to some of the legal questions that have been sent to us by our listeners. And if you have a question for Seamus, of course, you can contact inquiries@highlandradio.com. You can text 086 6025000, that number good for WhatsApp messages as well. Or you can call 074 9125000, 0035 374 9125000, if you're outside of the dialing area. Question about a joint account and changes made to it. Now, this is, as I understand it, a case of marriage separation. The account would have had a mandate for both parties to sign. However, a debit card was issued for one person, and then the address on the account was changed to the new address of the estranged husband. This was done without the consent or signature of the other party, the wife. A complaint was launched to the bank. The bank then returned with a statement that the debit card was cancelled, and the account address could only be changed back to the original address with the signature of both parties. And as a gesture of goodwill, the bank has offered €250. It's going to take a bit of unpacking, I suspect. But yes, can legally a change be made to a joint account on the word of one person?
Well, that is a very Very good point. It goes maybe to the kernel point that's in the actual question itself. It's the mandate that you're referencing there. And you would have to tease out as to what the position was with regard that, because you could have, my understanding in banking, you could have a mandate, you could have a joint account where either party can sign and authorize the dealings on the joint account, or it can be a joint mandate required. Now, we're assuming for the purpose of this question that the both signatures are required and that something was advanced by way of a change in the account by one signature only. I think that the reason why I'm assuming that is that there at the end of it, which is quite telling, I think there's a there was you mentioned a gesture on the bank, a gesture of goodwill, making some type of an offer of 200 or 250 euros. So if there was not some little issue arising, I don't believe that the bank would be making that contribution in the first instance. If it is stated as it is actually is that the mandate required the two signatures, then it should not have been acted upon by one signature only.
It then
We
begs the
need to know
question,
you
though.
need, but we would need to know the actual terms of that to be fair and to be fair to both sides. If it's a mandate whereby we hold a joint account, but I have the authority or you have the authority to sign to deal with the account, one signature only, there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion, either. So that's the key to it. If it was set up in such a way that two signatures are required, I think there is definitely an issue. If the caller is not happy, and this is an avenue open to them, if they are not happy and they don't want to go down the legal route, as it were, to get involved in litigation with a bank, which you could understand why, with the type of monies and the exposure to costs, well, then they could consider going down the route of the Financial Services Ombudsman and raising an issue with them, and they would have a look at it and see it, has there been some shortcomings on the bank. But to be fair, in relation to the bank, we can't make a call on that without knowing the actual detail of the mandate and who had the correct authority to sign on it. So I th think th those are the avenues that are open to the caller to advance it further if they so wish. And I think it is, I say, that it's just instructive that they have made some goodwill offer there. And therefore, I think that if they're not satisfied, the Financial Services Ombudsman route might be the way to go. And I don't believe there's a cost involved in that.
Yeah, it's also potentially telling that the bank of apparently sort of said, well, we can only change back to the original address with the signature of both parties. So that's
Very,
potentially telling as well.
yeah, well, it does. It infers that, but
Yeah.
we're trying to be balanced and being
Of
fair to
course.
the bank too. So if there was something on the mandate that was different that allowed one to sign, it could form a different view on it. But it is of interest, yeah.
Next question. My husband's father died 3 years ago. The will has not yet been read. They say they won't read the will and that we can't see it. If we are beneficiaries, can we not see the will? We did get a letter to say that we are beneficiaries. My husband had to sign a document to say that he was a beneficiary, yet we still haven't been told what's in the will. Where do we stand
Yeah.
with this? Presumably,
It's
this is the responsibility of the executors,
it,
or
well, of
executor, as
course,
the
it
case
is.
may be, yeah.
And the executor or executors, singular or plural, are the people in charge of responsibility for dealing with the estate after the deceased passed away, for getting all the valuations of property and assets and personal estate of the deceased at the date of death, and proceeding to complete the statement of affairs and the probate papers to admit the will to probate. The caller says there's 3 years has passed and nothing has happened, and yet they have been confirmed that they are beneficiaries. In probate actions, probate situations, there is what's called an executor's year, which is the period of time that it is allowed for the executor to act and to start working on the estate. After that period has passed, and somebody has an interest in the estate as a beneficiary or as a residuary legatee, and there's no action. In circumstances such as that, and they can consult their legal people about this, they could consider then taking an action themselves in the probate court by way of issuing a citation to have the will admitted for probate, to force action on the part of the executor, or to even have them removed as executor and have someone else appointed. So that's the course of action that they might wish to consider, given that the 3 years has passed.
I mean, I'm aware of a case recently where a person was left a small bequest from an uncle of whom they were jointly very, very fond of each other and were close, and the uncle left a small bequest, and I think within about 3 or 4 months of the uncle's death, she received a letter informing her that she had been left he had bequeathed a small percentage of his estate to her. The letter included a photocopy of the will, and then there was a notice at this letter from the solicitor said this has not yet been gone through the execution process. This still hasn't gone through probate. We don't know what the figure is. This is going to take some time. But here's a copy of the will. This is the bequest you've been given. And there was a full photocopy included there. So there shouldn't be any impediment to the actual will itself being shared, provided that sort of codicil is added, that it has to go through probate before anything can be drawn down.
Yes, well, I think that what you're inferring there, Donal, in practical terms, communication is key in all these issues. And if people are kept up to speed as to what the position is, I don't think there should be any difficulties arising. In relation to the point about them seeing a full copy of the will, I might slightly disagree on that, in that it's my opinion that it is the referable part of the will in which they have an interest. So, for example, just if somebody has left €100 in a will and they want to see a full copy of the will, well, the executor could say, well, yes, of course you can see the bequest that you have been left and how it has been recited in the will. And that's what you're entitled to. But you're not entitled to a full copy of the will at this stage. But then after it goes to probate, well, then that could be a different matter.
Another will-related question. If some family members are refusing to send their local solicitor details regarding PPS and so on, will a will go to probate? Will this delay the process, and for how long?
It will delay the process, Donald. How long? I'm not in a position to say it, because if it sits, it's static. It's a requirement, a mandatory requirement, actually, that the PPS number of the deceased and the beneficiaries is recorded in order to complete what used to be an Inland Revenue affidavit, now a statement of affairs, and so that is submitted with the probate papers to extract the grant of probate. The reason being, I understand, is in respect of, for the purpose of revenue. So, like everyone has, association you have, a relationship you are to the deceased, has a threshold in respect of capital acquisitions tax. And if you're a stranger, it's now up to 20k, and a nephew or niece or sibling is 40. And then if you are the son, daughter, then it's 10 times that at 400k. So that's the requirement for it. I'm not sure why there's an issue with it. You can, if you haven't had one before, you can apply to the Department of Social Protection and obtain one, even if you haven't been a resident in the state. We have seen it very, very frequently, actually. If somebody is a non-resident of in the state here, but is a beneficiary in an estate within this jurisdiction, they still require a PPS number, and it can be applied for here. And it's not at all that onerous. I don't see the difficulty with it, but it is a requirement. And if they're not forthcoming, yes, it will be delayed, and they'd want to consult with their legal people as to where they go from there.
Let's move on to another question, and I think you hopefully will have seen a copy of this already, Seamus. Can you please ask Seamus to explain what this means on the end of a will? It's very important to see where the family stands to explain this bit. Thank you. Now, I don't know if codicil is the right wording here, but it seems to suggest that a residence is being left in equal shares for their own absolute use and benefit, but subject to a right of residence in favour of my carer and personal and devoted friend, the person is named, for the term of her natural life or until such time as she owns a dwelling house of her own. I direct that my executors shall have an absolute discretion with regard to the interpretation of this clause insofar as it relates to the person in question.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. It's definitely a tricky one. We're back down to the executors. The key to it is the very end. The direct my executor shall have absolute discretion with regard to the interpretation. The interpretation, to me, seems clear enough in that it's from reading it, it's likely that a property has been left in equal shares, so it's more than one share to some people or somebody. And it's subject to this clause that it's in favour of an individual that they would be able to live in this dwelling house until such time as they have their own. Now, that's very, very broad. That could mean that, you know, they could have their day in it, their right of residence. It doesn't say upkeep, maintenance and support, but they could have the right of residence in it for their natural life and for the term of their natural life. Or it says then, or until such time as they should have a dwelling house of their own. Now, if they don't activate the or, it says for the term of their natural life. So my interpretation of that is that, if you want me to call it, that is a right of residence in the dwelling house for their lifetime if they don't buy or obtain for themselves alternate accommodation in a dwelling house of their own. Where the difficulty arises maybe is that it mentions then at the end that there is a discretion with regard to the interpretation of this clause. So how the executors will interpret that, I'm not in a position really to judge if they want to exercise their discretion, does that mean that they can vary that? Is that using too much discretion? I'm sure the individual who has been left the right could possibly challenge it. So that is where the grey area lies, and that could give rise to difficulties. If you're in a position where you are acting on behalf of the individual who is receiving the benefit of the term in the dwelling house for their natural life, you would be saying, well, that's up to them if they want to exercise that, and they're not obligated to obtain or buy their own home at all. While on the other side, the other interpretation would be maybe the executors would say, well, it's there, it's for convenience, but it's in the anticipation that you will one day own your own home and that you won't be there for the rest of your days. So that's the grey area.
How important is the word absolute in there? Because the word absolute would suggest that there's not necessarily a right to challenge the executor decision. If that word is absolute, the executor can just say, well, it's my right under the wording of the will to decide as I have decided without the need to explain. Absolute is a very straightforward word.
I think you've taken it out of context. The absolute refers to the shares that are left to the individuals for their own right. Absolute.
No, I'm using that. I think the last line was the absolute discretion of the executor.
To the discretion. Yeah. The absolute is not applying to the discretion.
Yeah.
It's applying to the shares that are left to the individuals for their own use and benefit.
Well, yeah,
so
but
that's their own use and benefit, absolutely. So they will entirely own it.
Yeah, of
for
course.
Their own use and benefit, but it's subject to this right for the individual during their natural life to reside in the dwelling house. So that's the point. So it's not an absolute discretion that they're referring to there. It is the rights that go with the shares.
So when they say, I direct that my executors shall have an absolute discretion with regard to the interpretation of this clause.
In that respect, it means that is limited to the executors to interpret
all right.
That.
Yeah. That's right.
But it still gives rise to the same issue as to how they exercise that discretion could be challenged by the individual who's left the right to live in the house. Because in that instance, there is this element of vagueness of for their natural life or until such time until they have a dwelling house of their own. So it's the way it's drafted. It depends what side you're on and how you want to run with it. But certainly you would see that the individual who's given a term of her natural life, that's there in black and white also. So the absolute discretion, it gives them, they're the only ones with the discretion to deal with it. Making a call on it, if it's challenged, it could give rise to litigation. Now, you would want to, after seriously look at the costs and consequences of going down that route, and may never arise. The individual may, of course, get their own home and everything move on. So, but there is just that grey area in it.
Seamus Gunn.
Which lawyers love, by the way.
Yeah, Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors, Remelton and Letterkenny. Thank you very much indeed, as always, Seamus. It's always a pleasure. And people can look forward to hearing your sage advice and commentary on the show very shortly in the future. But for now, Seamus, thank you.
Thank you, Donald.
The yellow wind warning that's coming into effect at midday will become an orange wind warning from 2 o'clock this afternoon. So as the old saying goes, please be careful out there. And we're just getting some notifications in from people who are predicting what may be happening. We mentioned this already, Trenta Presbyterian Church, due to the predicted stormy weather and safety concerns, Trenta Church has taken the regrettable decision to postpone events that were taking place this weekend. We hope to do something again in early spring, and we hope to see you then. Also, KGU Rovers Bingo will be cancelled tonight as a result of that orange weather warning. Now, we're going to go to our guest in studio. Delighted to be joined by Mary Herlihy, who's manager of Donegal Women's Centre. Mary, great to see you. And it's great to have you. The Women's Centre, in collaboration with a panel of skilled facilitators, has launched a series of transformative programmes aimed at supporting women who have been through the probation or judicial system. This is an important one, isn't it?
Oh, it's very important. I suppose through our work with the centre, we realised that behind every scenario, there's a woman there who has suffered extreme trauma or domestic abuse or neglect, or, you know, there's always a reason. And women going through the judicial system started to become more of an issue with our clients and the people that we work with. So it was a matter of sitting down and trying to address the issue from a holistic gender-based view on why this was happening. So the programmes came to be then through that, through actually our work with the clients on what their needs were. And obviously there is the court system, there is the probation, there's community service, there's all of that. But there was nothing there to look after them from a health and well-being point of view, from a mental health, from a non-judgmental place. And that's where we stepped in. This is our third year running this one of the programmes. And this new one that we've just launched is particularly new. And it came from feedback within the group itself on what they would like as they integrate back into the community again.
I suppose one of the things that someone who's been through the judicial system needs is hope. And hope is going to be very important in terms of rehabilitation, because if you can see a future, you'll work for that future. If you can't see a future, then we're going down a slippery slope.
Absolutely. And that is vital. It's that hope and non-judgmental. It doesn't matter what they have done. They will, you know, I suppose, pay their price or serve their time or whatever it is, you know, the sayings that we put on it. But it is hope and it's non-judgment. And it is that there is a future after whatever they have done, for whatever reason that they have done that particular crime. And we're talking, you know, pretty low level stuff, but obviously it has an impact on the community. But we tend to see it from the community's point of view and not from the person themselves. And that's where these programmes are vital. We see beyond what has happened, why they were in court. It doesn't really matter, but it is giving them that hope, that future. And that then feeds into security for the children within the family, within the wider family and within the community. So they become more integrated back into their community and essentially back into themselves, you know, to have that space to look at what was going on for me, where was I going, you know, the reasons I made the decision, or maybe not knowing why I made the decision at the time to do whatever it was. But I know I can move past it. It doesn't make me the person that I am.
How important is it that things like education feed into this process as well? Education, support, and perhaps saying to someone, look, there are courses you can do. There's a road you can go down that can maybe better equip you to make better decisions into the future, and also perhaps equip you to re-enter the workforce or whatever.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of this project is that we're working with a skilled panel of facilitators. So they understand and, you know, coming from a trauma-informed centre, that there is that understanding of what made the woman that she is today, you know, what was going on. And that education, that awareness, that, you know, those skills of resilience, those resources, the toolkit that they'll walk away with. And one of the things was that some of the women wanted to go back into employment, but were very hesitant because of their background, because of having a conviction. Others wanted to start up their own businesses, doing various things. But again, it was that the judgment, I have a conviction, will that come against me? So it is about normalising it. It is about saying, look, this has happened. you know, you've paid your dues, let's move on, what's next, and how we can support you. And very often these women may have left school early. You know, there can be a lot of issues maybe that they didn't get into the same opportunities maybe as other people have. And then we have others that are in very well, you know, very good jobs and just made a bad decision in a matter of seconds. None of that matters, you know, once they're in the room. And we don't focus on why they're there. You know, they're just a group like every other group. So it's not about sitting and saying, I did this or I did that. It is about having that hope. It's about empowering the women to take back their own power. It is about making sure that they have the skills and the resources going forward.
How do people get involved? I mean, obviously, there's going to be a certain amount of self-referral, but are you taking referrals through other sources as well? Or how if someone is in a position where they could benefit from this, how do they get in touch, or what's the process?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have two programmes. So one of them is a health and wellbeing programme, and the other is this education piece, this empowering, but getting back into the workforce or self-employment. So they just contact the centre. We will take referrals from solicitors, from the court system, from guards, from GPs, public health nurses, anybody who's working with a woman who finds herself in this position and thinks, actually, I know a programme that might be of use. So we take referrals from anybody. Family members and friends are also very welcome to ring us, along with that self-referral piece as well. So it's wide open. There's no criteria that you have to meet. You may be out of the system for a while and interested in starting back into employment or self-employment, and you're very welcome to contact us as well. So it's wide open, and it's from any age, from the age of 17 up. So there's no barrier. We're keeping it as barrier-free as we can, and to encourage people to come into us. With that, there's also some counselling available as well as part of the programme, and they can avail of both programmes or either one of them. So, you know, it's just whatever the woman is able to commit to and feels the right path for her to go forward with.